Hello, I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
And we're here with a special message from Androids and Assets.
We are going to change the show. Some of you might have noticed we've been infrequently posting lately. And it's because we are tired.
We live in a capitalist society that demands that we work and also make art. That part isn't a demand, but we feel compelled.
We love doing this show and we want to do it, but doing it weekly was unsustainable. On the X and the Y axis, oh God.
The whole chart said stop.
And so we're keeping going. don't fret. There will still be Androids and Assets content, but it's just going to come out once a month. Variable timetable.
Sometime each month, there will be a new episode for you to listen to. I'm not going to promise it'll be on the third Monday or anything like that. But you'll get something. You will hear our voices semi-regularly.
This also has implications for Emissaries of Prophets, which is on indefinite hiatus.
We thought we could get through all of DS9.
Curse our hubris.
Overestimated and overextended.
We know not what we do.
We appreciate you being here through this difficult time. Thank you for your support. We will not be taking questions.
All those flash bulbs, yeah. You hear them smashing on the ground.
We traveled back in time.
Yeah. I'm a newsie, see? Tell me, what's the big picture? We'll have an episode for you in April and an episode for you in May. And just, what a month. Moving forward. God damn it. I got the paper out. I got the pen to write something down.
So, like, we're going to do something in April and then in May. But, and then, like, in June and then in July.
And then you're just listing months. Yeah. That's just fucked up.
Just around the year out, August, September, October, November, December. That's when we're going to...
You're going to get one more episode in March and then, but just this one. And then it's going to be monthly after that.
Hello, and welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
This is the show where we talk about the political economy of speculative fiction. That is, how decisions are made, how wealth is distributed, and how in a fight for the very survival of humanity in a cold, uncaring universe, it's important to pick your allies. Today we are joined by Evan of Kino Lefter to discuss the sixth and final season of The Expanse on Amazon Prime. Welcome, Evan.
Hello, Marshall and Steven, and what's up, Androids and Assets Nation? I'm happy to be back.
I think this is the first time we've named our fandom, so.
I think I've suggested fans of my show should be called Keeners. I don't know if anyone has taken that up. Identity is such a shifting, complex beast nowadays, so. I don't know. We'll soon know with the hindsight of history.
Evan, I do want you to know that our fans are actually organized into an elaborate hierarchy of
great.
You know, and people are assigned titles and positions based on an algorithm. They get their blockchain token for their mm-hmm. you know, they can be like a node or a drone or a nexus point.
It's fair, and I'm excited to earn my merit points from guesting on the show.
You'll be making node before you know it. This season of The Expanse covers Babylon's Ashes, the sixth but not final book in The Expanse series, and it follows the final struggle between Marco Inaris' Free Navy and the Inner Planets.
Dun, before dun, dun. Before we hit record on the show, we were discussing whether we should be calling this the final season, because obviously there's three more books, but the show is stopping now. So it's like, well, is it going to get picked up by someone who's not Amazon? Not that we're here to discuss that, but I don't think that's likely. I'm just like, if Amazon paid for it and wanted it, they would keep it. Like, it's doing well, it's popular. I think they're just like, this is the best place to end the story we're telling, because after this it gets weird and we don't want to deal with that.
I'm waiting for the sequel trilogy to The Expanse, where they bring on a creative mind like J.J. Abrams to say, what do you think would happen next in the universe of our story? Bring back all the old favorites. Play the hits.
Man. What do you call something like after The Expanse?
Still expanding.
The contraction.
The contraction. That's good.
We've got a showrunner, folks. There it is.
You're getting a sneak peek into the writer's room right now. I think that's pretty exciting.
This is where the belt comes and oppresses Earth with their school curriculums.
The belt has invented reverse racism.
Jordan Peterson is commanding a battleship. We must attack.
Ceres Station, look around. No one's cleaning anymore, for God's sakes. How do you expect to beat the inners if you're living in shit?
Make your crash couch. that's good advice. I think there's going to be spoilers. I don't know if we're being really super careful about events in the continuity of the Expanse universe. So if you're worried about that, goodbye. Bye.
See you in the next one.
It's just not for you. It's just not for you at this time. And that's okay. I don't think that's nothing wrong with us, nothing wrong with you. I do want to point out one thing, which bugs me, and it's just, again, being like having read the books, and it's a very rather pedantic point, but how they kind of like in the books, the role of Kermina Drummer is actually performed by Michio Pa. And in the TV series, Michio Pa is relegated to a very a weird role inside that story.
I have not finished that book, but as I've had it explained to me, the in the books there's Drummer and Michio, and in the show they've sort of combined those into two,
yes,
and just reused the name Michio for someone else.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, that is exactly what they did. Yeah, I mean, Karagi is a very strong actor,
fantastic.
Yeah,
we stand.
So I Alberta understand excellence. Why,
right? Yeah, I guess we can claim that.
One thing that's not embarrassing.
You mentioned Michio. I did not realize that Michio and Drummer and the other people on her ship were all married.
They were a polycule?
I did not understand that. Sure. If that's the word for it, I don't know. I mean, yeah. Later I was reading something and it was like, oh, you know, like Drummer has just lost all of her spouses. And I was like, sorry, what now? They were all married. The show did not make that clear, at least to me. I don't know. Maybe I just was missing the key.
They all sleep in one bed.
One big bed. as a solely show viewer, I was definitely under the impression that they were all in a relationship. I thought that was more clear in the earlier seasons. But I don't know if they officially tied the knot. So, yeah. You gotta keep your friends close, your crewmates, you know, just having an argument in the middle of a battle. It's incredible.
It is January. I mean, it is February 1st today, and Albertans and Canadians in general are in the depths of, the whiny crybaby. Yeah, the crybaby convoy to the border, to stop Brussels sprouts from coming in to, I don't know, I guess, affect change.
Some consider it the greatest revolution of the 21st century. I am one of them. I believe that this is an extraordinary moment for worker power. That is a joke. That's a joke, everybody. Okay, having a little fun.
Oh, God. So most of the season of the Expanse is just a big old war. The Belters and the Martians and Earth and everybody, Belter on Belter, Earth on Belter, Belter on Earth.
All the different styles, all the different genres.
That's right. But it's to me it was interesting the way that they had to like form alliances. So like Earth and Mars historically rivals and ready to shoot missiles at each other. We're like, yeah, we don't have enough ships left individually to have a proper fleet. So like let's team up because Inaros is he's a bad news for all of us. And then not all the Belters agree with Inaros. So then, you know, they split and factionalize, but Inaros is like, no, I speak for the entire belt. It was just very neat to see the various coalitions that formed and broke apart and reformed throughout the whole season. And maybe I'm only thinking about this because we just talked to Gautam Bhatia about the Horizon and like the various coalitions and like concessions that you make to people to get them to be on your side, where you're like, yeah, like we mostly want the same thing for us all not to die, but also we have other individual concerns that maybe are at odds that we're willing to set aside briefly, but need to be addressed as well in this. So like when Christian Avasarala reaches out to Kamina Drummer and is like, look, you got to fight with us because neither of us are going to win on our own. And Drummer's just like, I don't know. Like you've killed a lot of my people. I'm like, yeah, like I did. Sure.
I'm gonna own that,
but I'm going to stop. I promise I won't kill any more Belters.
I can stop killing Belters whenever I want. Okay, it's not a serious problem. That was the old me.
Oh, Chrissy. Yeah, I think it's important, and I think it really is a good way to diagnose Inaros' failure, right? In the sense that Inaros sees arms as an end in itself, so he's always trying to procure arms and trying to preserve force, you know, preserve it and strategically deploy his force, so much so that he fails to provide, you know, security or articulate a vision for the belt that is really central to his downfall. I think there's in the show they make a big deal about the caches they accumulate because they kind of loot a lot of the Belters' stuff to stockpile it. That's a problem. I don't know if it's as big a problem in reality because there is also a thing where there's a thing where armed groups loot. It's not good for you politically, but you can survive it. I think and armed groups do. Routinely.
Yeah, I think that sort of the coalition building and the sort of like negotiations between factions for whatever the future of the Sol system will be, that was, I mean, the most interesting part of the season to me, because I mean, it's like the central idea, because the show ends with people around a table trying to divvy up power. And yeah, it made me think sort of more about the Free Navy and Inaros and sort of like how exactly I feel about like that decision to be like the big villain of the show. In terms of like entertainment value, I think the Free Navy is great. And I think the performance of like Marco Inaros and everything, terrific. He's an interesting villain. He's got a lot of dimensions to him. I'm still not entirely sure how I feel about this sort of like, and I don't want to like simplify the narrative of the Expanse or anything, but like they have to put down like revolutionary violence that has like gone too far as like the end of this show. And this feels like a very common trend to me where villains tend to be people who have good intentions, correctly identify an issue within the power structure, like how the belt is oppressed by the inners, and then they do something that is so unspeakably evil that they can never be redeemed in the eyes of the audience, such as killing half of the Earth, like Marco Inaros does in this show, which is, of course, like, you know, a bit too far, I would argue. I would personally not destroy the planet Earth, you know, in retaliation for you know, the oppression that the Belters face. But I mean, the show is complicated enough. It's like, oh, like, I mean, one of the last lines of the show is Holden going like, you know what? Marco Inaros was right. You're giving the Belters a raw deal. But in terms of like Inaros being like a complicated figure, like the audience maybe going like, oh, you know, maybe I side with him. absolutely not in this season. Like, he is just a target to be eliminated. And there's obviously huge Bin Laden vibes with Marco and Naros. Like, without 9/11, you could not write The Expanse.
That's interesting. I had not thought of that, of like, without 9/11, you couldn't write The Expanse. It's true. I like it.
Yeah. Well, this is, well, when we came on your show to talk about The Expanse, this is what we talked about, transmuting Hezbollah into Al-Qaeda, which is, I think, a thing that people, you know, in the West do all the time. They just see, like, Islamic political militancy, broad strokes, and just be like, yeah, it's all the same. It's all the same. There's no nuance or difference there. And that is inaccurate, right? Because if there is Al-Qaeda, you know, does just value getting bodies, right? They just want to go in and blow shit up and make a big noise. They don't really care to develop a state or anything, you know? Whereas, like, Hezbollah exists in political coalition. It's part of the Lebanese government. It's part of the Lebanese army. It exists part and parcel of a movement for political change and stands and honors its central purpose, which is to resist Israel. They exist for one reason, where they exist to keep Israel out of South Lebanon. And they have been extremely successful in doing so.
And I think, like, the OPA as a political organization was like, we want proper representation for the belt and to be recognized as like a people and a nation and a state. And then Marco Inaros was like, yeah, that's all well and good and everything, but I just want to kill Earthers.
And he effectively destroys.
That's what I'm looking for in this. And the OPA is just about ruined because of it. And then Drummer, you know, sort of patches together her own little coalition of people who are like, this is not really what we signed up for, but if we said no to him, he was going to throw us out in airlocks. So, like, you know, we went along with it briefly. And that's how, like, Earth ends up seeing them. And that's why Mars is able to take such advantage of Arnaros, and, like, or at least the rebel faction of Mars is like, yeah, we'll give you a couple of crappy ships and you'll cause a war. And then we can just disappear. Nobody looking at us.
This is also the timing of not just this book, but the previous book coming out contemporaneously to the Syrian civil war, right? Mm-hmm. And how what you have and ISIS, right? And so to the extent that, you know, the thing that allowed the Syrian opposition, which ultimately became ISIS and HTS and other groups, were armed by the U.S., right? That they, you can have, you don't need to have, again, a strong political coalition if you get a bunch of high-tech, very strategically relevant arms dumped in your lap. And that's very interesting. So, like, you see this, like, the, you know, Inaros is a construct of Mars.
Yeah.
Which is fruit of the poisonous
tree. And like, Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, right?
Yeah.
They probably would have been nothing, except that we gave them a lot of big guns. And then they became very dangerous.
Yeah, but yeah, Osama bin Laden is the creation of the Central Intelligence Agency, the Saudi Army, and the Inter-Service Intelligence Agency of Pakistan. Like, that's where he comes from. They made him.
I'm imagining the Powerpuff Girls intro with all of that being sprinkled to create Osama bin Laden. I don't know. I think the show could have been a lot worse for me because, I mean, you do get those different perspectives about, like, what the belt should be doing, mostly by the duality of Drummer and Inaros. And, like, the opposition to Inaros isn't like, stop, all revolutionary violence is bad and you need to fall in line with the Inners or something.
Call to dialogue. And,
yeah, we cool heads will prevail, and I think we should maintain the status quo. Will leadership of the transport union secure a better future for the belt? Maybe. It's certainly a big chip in their favor, but I mean, the belt's got a lot of problems. They can't, you know, feed people. I mean, all supply lines and agriculture have been totally destroyed because of this war. So, you know, cautiously optimistic about the future of the belt. Earth is absolutely a graveyard, so I don't think anything can, help our mother planet there. And, you know, Mars is dead too, so it's such a fascinating ending, right? Because, like, the belt is really the only faction that achieves, like, a serious gain by the end of this conflict. and I mean, the show is setting up that everyone will lose it, you know, once Laconia is able to take over everything by dipping their toes into some alien technology that they shouldn't have. But no, I think we can all agree that James Holden is the number one ally of the century by giving up his power to Kamina Drummer. It is like, I mean, it's a good move. I'm glad that he saw the opportunity to do it. But in terms of like, how will this actually change the relationship between the belt and the inner planets? I mean, that's sort of just my desire to go like, well, what happens next? Which doesn't need to be answered by the show. But I thought it was a cool note to end on, especially with like the thesis of this season being like, you know, uneasy alliances and having to, you know, band together whatever you can to deal with, you know, the crisis in front of you.
I was very surprised at the end that they were even bothering with the transport union, and that Earth and Mars got to dictate so much of it. Because I was like, aren't you both just going to abandon your planets, though, and find livable ones? Like, the Belters are the only ones who are stuck where they're at because so many of them have undergone, you know, like, physiological changes that prevent them from being able to live on a planet. Their children could, of course, live on a planet and visit their parents on a station or something. I don't know. Irrelevant and unimportant. But I would have thought that Earth and Mars are basically just like, so we're going to put people on ships, and those ships are going to ferry back and forth between planets until these planets are empty because they're useless hunks of garbage now. We don't need a transport union for that, do we?
I think you need to administrate that process. And I think, you know, like that's what the transport union is. It's going to.
I think you need to make sure that you don't get eaten up by the alien presence that exists within the gates. I think that's another important reason for their existence.
But like, it's going to be a very finite process, right? Like, you're not coming back to the soul system after. Like, there's nothing there for you. Maybe in a 100,000 years when the Earth has cooled off a bit and the sky is not full of dust. I don't know.
But I mean, you know, a lot of money is going to be changing hands. There's going to be like those ships still have to go. Who's going to get to profit off that? Who gets to say how that's done? Who's going to set the rate of these changes? You know, I think it's very. Yeah, well,
the market. You know.
I think that's exactly why the trans. The transfer union exists to exactly not prevent that, to exactly stop that, right? And to cool down this planet rush.
But why would, I mean, I just don't understand why Earth was like, we should cool down this planet rush. Like, all of our people are slowly suffocating on a planet, but let's slow down getting off of here.
Well,
it doesn't make sense to me.
We're getting into stuff in the subsequent books now. I think some of these questions are definitely answered a little bit.
I mean, maybe I, again, like I said, I haven't read the books, but I just don't know why Christian Avasarala was like, we should be very careful about how we leave this planet, instead of being like, we need to commandeer every ship that we can and just stuff it full of bodies.
Mm-hmm. I think there might also be concern about like the alien technology that they encountered on, was it Illis? If it's like, let's send out people everywhere, then like, could 60% of them die by accidentally touching a glowing blue orb? I feel like there are so many unknowns with the gates. They shouldn't touch orbs. Orbs have done nothing good for us as of late, except for crystal balls, which we can use to accurately predict the future. I feel like. Sorry, what if that was the thing I believed in? I thought that could be kind of funny. There's certainly a lot of question marks and with humanity's journeying into the gates. And I feel like it's so difficult to traverse those rings because there's like the slow zone, of course, scary red energy worms. The threat of like, you know, what if you land on a planet and oops, you breathed in the wrong spore and now you're dead. So I feel like some authority managing that. Not sure about the time frame, but maybe there could be some cheddar in some belter pockets because of it.
Well, I mean, yeah, this is why the transport union exists, to stop to regulate the flow of traffic so that they don't wake up the bad thing inside the gates.
I really enjoyed the joke that Jeff Bezos shut down the Expanse as soon as he heard that there was a union.
Yeah, it's very funny to me that Jeff Bezos loves the Expanse book series, and I think that's the reason why Amazon bought the show in the first place. But I mean, when you're that wealthy, it doesn't matter what you personally believe. I think, you know, he has to manage an empire. It doesn't care if he was really affected by the plight of the Belters or whatever.
That Jules Pierre Mao guy, he's got a lot of good points.
Visionary.
Jeff Bezos would absolute. He is probably doing some Jules Pierre Mao stuff right now. I think, obviously, Jeff Bezos needs to be investigated for a lot of things. I think he literally does have proto-molecule. I think he sent a vision to the past, to the authors, James S.A. Corey, both of them, and was just like, look at this shit. And then like, what? And then they had a dream, and then they made the Expanse.
Okay, just what about Laconia, though? Because we don't hear much about Laconia.
No.
We really know is that, like, they were a breakaway faction from Mars. They gave Inaros a few ships so that he had enough of a free navy to become the leader of the free navy. And then that they fucked off to a planet that they renamed Laconia and became a military dictatorship.
Mm-hmm. I think Laconia was like the province of Greece or the area of Greece that Sparta was in. And I mean, it would be too on the nose to call your space fascist society like New Sparta or whatever. I like Laconia. And not as a political entity, as a name. But yeah, every episode of this season of The Expanse starts on Laconia, and I think they adapt the novella Strange Dogs, if I'm not wrong. Of course, there are some weird dogs on Laconia, which are able to resurrect the dead, but in some, like, horrible half-life state, which I think is very symbolic of the Laconian society. But I really liked those scenes. I think they stood out to me watching the season, just about how, like, people sort of live in fear of, they're both excited about the possibility of, like, getting to start anew and renew the dream of Mars. But then they always talk about, like, how the soldiers are running everything. And, like, you know, there's martial law, and, like, the person who hit, the scientist kid is just going to be killed somewhere. They don't know. It's like that line of, like, what do you think's going to happen to him sticks out to me. We get a little bit of Admiral Duarte, who I'm led to believe will play a larger role in the next few books, being the leader of Laconian civilization. It's just fascinating. And of course, that thing hovering over Laconia is like a ring builder ship that's half finished that they're able to reverse engineer and create their own weapons and vessels from. So it's a bad society, I have to say. You know, I've assessed it, and I think that fascism in the stars, generally not a good idea, but very appealing, which is the, you know, a problem. I do want to pet the dogs, though. I thought the dogs looked really cute, and they're friendly. They want to be around you. They want to resurrect your dead child. I feel like who doesn't want that? And they have the little bristles on their head. I'd love to give them a little rub.
I mean, I'm putting in my will that if the dogs are around, like, feed me to them. I want to come back with those dogs.
And you get proto-molecule vision. Very excited.
Yeah. If I have to die for that technology, like, so be it. It's a price I'm willing to pay. You say it's a half-life. I say it's a life we just haven't experienced yet.
So true. And yeah, I like that sort of like the rise of Laconia recontextualizes the whole conflict of the Free Navy, where you know, Inaros and the Free Navy are just a tool to, you know, create chaos. Duarte is very Vladimir Putin-like. He wants to sow dissent within the Sol system. I like that because, I mean, it takes away this, like, I think, well, I think it intentionally adds, like, a boogeyman effect to Inaros, right? Like, he's just a tool, and, like, he isn't, like, this singular evil bad guy like the Emperor or something. Like, you know, he's just being used for someone else to gain something, and I feel like that's very much in the spirit of how the series views politics.
When you say, like, how the series views politics, what do you mean by that? Like, that is just
Yeah, I can expand on that idea. Just how all decisions are like a series of trade-offs, and in order to do anything, you need to create certain alliances and concessions, like much like we were talking about. And a lot of this is being done outside of public view, and there's no accountability or anything. So I think that that's in line with, you know, the UN and Mars and how they're, you know, manipulating the belt or the media or the crew of the Rocinante. So I think that Duarte, you know, he's a military guy, but he's also a very sound strategist. Like, it's just everything is a zero sum game, and he's extremely committed to one vision of the future, one that he will not accept any deviation from, which is, like, very different from most of the characters of The Expanse. I think most characters are just, like, out for survival within a system that wants them dead. And Duarte is just like, I am going to create a new system, and then you will all be subjugated by it, and I will set the rules of it. So, I mean, that's, like, you know, just the rejection of, you know, democracy or, you know, and any kind of idea of, like, you know, leaders serving people, and just, you know, we need to win power, and that's the only way to, like, survive and maintain purity in, like, you know, that dream of Mars sense.
The show, and I'm guessing the books as well, it does take a pretty pessimistic view of systems of governance. That is just like, yeah, like, every leader is actually corrupt. They just are. They're either corrupt or ineffective.
Yeah. I think that's largely right. I think a lot of media that deals with politics, I mean, it's not inaccurate to say that a lot of these structures that are meant to serve us do not work. You know, it's no coincidence that the central cast are, like, a group of outsiders who collaborates with all different sides. But even someone like Ava Sarala, who is, like, very effective within the system, like, half of her planet dies, right? So how much can she, you know, really succeed within that? And, like, I don't think the series is, like, libertarian or anything. It's like, all authority is unjust. Like, I don't think that's what the series is trying to communicate.
You should read the next book. Oh, yeah. You should read the next book.
Well, oh, God.
See if you still...
But even, like, your example of Ava Sarala, she is very mm-hmm. effective, but for most of the time, when she's the most effective, she's actually unelected and has built up power, like, inside the system, but only through the bureaucracy and without ever having to actually be, like, a public face that's accountable to anybody. It's just like she gets to do her own thing because she's so powerful and is sort of like a mini tyrant within the UN. Mm-hmm. And then once she is accountable, almost immediately fails.
And this is a tangent, but it's connected to sort of how Earth's governance is depicted in the series. I've always had this sort of sneaking feeling. I haven't evaluated it too much, but it's kind of like anti-welfare in a sense. Like, the series is trying to communicate this idea that, like, you know, Earth is an empire in decline, And one of the symptoms of that is, like, most people on Earth do not have jobs and they rely on government assistance, which they call basic. And this is, like, taken, like, creativity and, like, this drive from Earth. And it's like, I don't like that. Like, I think that's a lazy storytelling device. You don't see it much in the series, but I know that's, like, a part of the world. So that has always rubbed me the wrong way.
It's definitely mentioned at some point. A couple of times it's mentioned. And, like, people need to find a job and hold, a crappy job for a few years to prove that they're willing to work. And I'm just sort of like, is that, like, do you really need to work at McDonald's for 5 years before people are like, I'm going to take you seriously now? Yes, you can go to school. I don't know. You're right. It's very anti-welfare, and pull yourself up by your bootstraps. If you don't have that internal drive, then you'll just waste away on booze and drugs and video games while the government pays your bills.
This is an anti-gamer piece of art, and for that reason, I cannot support it. We must destroy all copies of this book series.
But yes, I do. They take a very dim view of politicians, and seem to suggest that the only people who are effective are tyrants, and democracy is actually a failure.
Are you ready for my hot take on The Expanse?
I'm excited to hear it.
I'm never ready for your hot takes.
Hopefully, there's a hot take drop or something.
Yeah. The Expanse, the reason for all of this in The Expanse is because fundamentally, The Expanse, it, at least liminally, engages in Malthusianism, right? It embraces the Malthusian view that you can't attain prosperity because any gains you make in prosperity but gobbled up by people just having more babies. People are the problem and there's too damn many of us. And until we can curb that, we're doomed. Yeah, Malthus was a theologian and I think something of a mathematician as well. And he was kind of like, listen, like population is the problem and we need to control population at its core. That's not really a completely correct view, right? In the sense that there isn't a fixed capacity for things, right? And human population, is dependent on its resource base, but that is, as we're learning, variable. He posits this Malthusian view. There's just too many people on Earth. Right. And this is why they talk a lot about like lotteries and systems, like when they deal with Amos's backstory, like how he had to like basically cheat the lottery to get out. There just aren't any jobs, actually. Like you need to like win a lottery and then work. And then if you get a lottery for a job, you can work and then maybe go to university. Right. And the competition is so extreme and this flows from this Malthusian position. And that makes a lot of sense then in the context of the book, that what they get is it's positing this narrative about carrying capacity. And so logically that the conclusion of the book would be the vast, the exponential increase of worlds, and that this is exactly what Earth requires. The only answer to humanity at its core is for it to have more worlds to consume, right? Because it is in its own nature ever expanding and so fundamentally cancerous. I'm not going to say it like purports that as like how things actually are or how they should be, but it flirts with that in a lot of dimensions.
So, okay, maybe I missed the actual like hot take here.
The hot take is that this book is this series is Malthusian.
Boom.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I don't disagree.
And that's a problem.
Oh no, it's terribly wrong. It's horribly wrong. But I think a lot of people fall for that sort of fallacy of like, well, there's no way that Earth could maintain its population. If you look at any natural occurring population of animals, it undergoes sort of like growth until it natural forces cause it to come into decline. And that's what Malthus was really talking about, right? It was like, if there's too many humans, we won't be able to feed them all and then we'll all die. So like, it'll be a terrible suffering. Yeah.
Like the wolves, the wolves in the
reptiles. You'll just get it. Yes, exactly. Yeah. But humans stopped following any sort of like natural population patterns a couple of hundred years ago. who just sort of were like, nah, we don't go for that anymore. And we've gone on a steady increase since.
And definitely have done so in the world of The Expanse. Like, birth control's available. Family planning exists universally in the world of The Expanse, right?
Well, yeah, but also, like, they have, like, what is it, 20 or 30 billion people living on Earth, which I don't think is actually that unreasonable. Mm-hmm. Right? There's a lot of efficiency gains that are still to be realized in farming and vertical agriculture and supply chains and
radioplasts
that we just haven't even realized yet. So once we all get our, like, NFTs of our own, the population is going to be able to just blast.
You know, it sort of ties into the central conflict of The Expanse, because Marco Inaros is a emerging musician, and the UN made an NFT of one of his songs. And he is just like, you will pay for this. And he's right.
That's why they go to war.
And I think one more aspect I'll say about, like, what the vision of life on Earth is like. Granted, I'm not an expert on the future of work, but I feel like with the way that capitalism currently exists, like, I don't see this situation where, oh, the spots at university, there's so much competition. Oh, so few people can hold, you know, X amount of jobs. I always feel like with the way that capitalism works, the system needs to find new markets to exploit and new kinds of labor to keep people busy. And technological innovation is a part of that too. Like, why wasn't Amos a streamer? Why isn't everyone a streamer? Like, they need drone delivery maintenance people. Like, I feel like everyone would just have a stupid, shitty little job that they hate, like we do today, but it would be even more dumber and even more abstracted, right? And it's just like, there isn't an app, right? It's some kind of implant, and you're just like, oh, I feel happy. I have to go to the warehouse and, you know, sort through the millions of boxes. Like, you know, I feel like that problem sort of feels unimaginative to me, where it's just like, everyone is lazy and on welfare. It's like, that's why they can't be in Inaros. They don't have the spirit. And it's like, come on. Like, you know, it's a bunch of bored warehouse workers listening to podcasts that radicalize them, that will give them the fire that they need to destroy the Free Navy and not consider the consequences of that or why the conflict started in the first place.
Which we've established as NFTs.
NFTs, exactly.
No, I think you're absolutely right, though, that rather than people not being able to work, it'll be people beaten into, like, a state of semi-consciousness, a fugue, all the time, because it's like, well, you know, costs of living have gone up and we just can't afford to keep paying all of you. So we are going to have to increase the minimum work, like the maximum working hours, to 60 hours a week. And we're really sorry, but, like, if we all just pull together, we know Earth can get ahead here. So, like, if you just do the 60, and that's kind of like a minimum, you know, real Earthers are doing 70 hours. Yeah. At a shitty job that actually does nothing.
You have
pushing
to, like,
paper from one place to another.
It's just like, you have to, like, keep, like, it's, you get images and you have to help their AI, like, what color is this? And you have to write down the hex code, and it's something like that, right? Something you would not be able to even explain to, you know, your closest friend, right? And it's just like, that's the future that I imagine, right? And I'm not saying, like, The Expanse needs to do that. But again, it's sort of like a world building thing. I feel like that's definitely something that a teenage version of me would make in the mid 2000s, which, I mean, they weren't teenagers when they made it, but I feel like it emerges from that sort of, like, RPG game mentality. And it feels like a first draft idea, right? But if they really, because that, I feel like the Earth and Earth society is something they're interested in through a small lens, which is Amos's character. Right. And then beyond that, it's not really important because it gets pulverized to shit. What's important is the belt and Mars and people leaving Mars to go to Laconia.
The way they view Earth, and this is where Amos's character is really important, is because they view the social welfare system as being fundamentally like a cronyized system of crime.
Yeah. Right.
That criminals have taken over all of the neighborhoods. and they've integrated themselves into the opportunity systems, and that, you know, and so that, like, you know, broader administration in society will lead to crime and criminal enterprise coming to predominance. And I think that's, you know, which is kind of like an old anti-Soviet smear, right? Like that all party bosses, gang party and union bosses are all gangsters. I think that's what they're appealing to there.
Yeah, it does come across as a pretty lazy and unimaginative sort of a future. You're just like, I don't know exactly what they're trying to critique, or if they even know what they're trying to critique with that.
Because there is a left criticism of things like UBI, right? That there could be like you could have like a universal basic income program or something that is, you know, like just a subsidy to the gig economy, which I think is kind of what we were talking about there, right? Where you get your basic social assistance, but you also stream. The other thing I want to talk about in the terms of the economy of Earth is land, which I think the thing that tells us the single most about Earth's economic system, in the sense that James Holden is created, right, out of his many parents, right, to be an inheritor of a piece of land, right? Because there's this basically private land still exists. It's permitted to exist, but it is largely being phased out, right? There's economic pressures to move thing to either, well, certainly increase density, or, you know, or, you know, break up larger land holdings. I don't know through what mechanism. That's either to turn them over to like agribusiness, or if it is to socialize them or distribute them in some way. I don't know. Clearly, there is a pressure acting on land, and this is very important to the authors who paint Holden's source of justice flowing from the messianic anticipation that's embedded on him of carrying forward this land and protecting it from reclamation by the government.
And so what does that say then about their politics?
I think it says they are concerned about social control of the economy. They're worried about, you know, that land, you know, land, you know, the inability to, well, or to barriers to inheritance, I guess, right? Or like things like that, you know, things that strive to break up generational wealth or to, you know, broader socialized land are bad things. Right. And that in this world, the radicals are trying to preserve the institution of private property against socialization. And that the broader loss of people's ability to engage in land ownership is a loss of right, which I think is something that is very sacred to American people in general. Like in general, when you talk to most Anglo Americans, they're like, how, you know, you're doing well? Oh, I own land.
Yeah. That's why you don't want a condo.
Yeah, because you don't get any of that sweet, sweet land. You just got a box in the sky that's melting.
Right. That's melting.
Or falling down.
The box is melting.
Well, both, actually.
I can see that. It does both the representation of UBI and people being forced to live in just large tenements, and the wealthy having, you know, large expenses of land. right, like we see Jules Pierre Mao and his property, and it's just like this large house with a tree and like
surrounded by a forest,
not being used like productively, right? It's just there. At least the Holdens have a farm, so it's like it's productive land. Even if it's not maybe the most efficient use of productive land, it's still productive land in Montana. And so it's like, you know, a good use of land, because they're definitely not doing like a left-wing critique of UBI that is like a marketization, but leaving everything to the market and saying, okay, well, we'll give you a UBI, but then like, you got to figure everything out on your own. Like you got to find your own housing and you got to find your own food and whatever. And it doesn't actually do anything to like reduce people's dependence or to make them more free. It's just like, yeah, it's just another way for landlords to get a buck, for the government to transfer money to landlords and to other people without doing it directly. And then they can also just be like, hands off. And if anything goes wrong, it's your fault. and you should have dealt with the market better and more efficiently, you dummy. They didn't do that.
Are the individuals behind SA Corey Georgists? This is my question. Do they have Georgist leanings? Is that why they're concerned about land?
What's a Georgist?
Georgists believe that like the taxation of land is like all you need to like enforcing the land taxes would be as all you need to like reorder the economy, because like all kind of other economic things flow from land. So by heavily taxing land, you will effectively redistribute land and then all wealth in society.
Interesting.
I don't think I'm a Georgist. Upon
no, I mean, there's
slipping my feelers in there for a second. Don't think that's for me.
Yeah, yeah. You got. I mean, it's very compelling on first read, and then you think about it a little bit, and I don't know if that would have the consequence you think it would have. Yes, they love small landholders, and don't we all? We all love small landowners, middle-sized farmers. You know, rural.
Well, the UN doesn't.
Earth doesn't respect hard work anymore.
That's right. You have to have 8 separate families joined together to hold one farm. And they can only have one kid. How are they supposed to even work that farm?
And one of those families on that Montana farm, the Duttons. Hi, I'm here to pitch Yellowstone 2350, my hit new show coming to Amazon Prime and Paramount Plus soon.
You've got it on both.
Yeah, because the rights, you know, it's a bit tough since Paramount Plus is the home of Yellowstone.
Right.
But I think Paramount Plus is primed to keep The Expanse going once they merge it with the Yellowstone universe. Because there's nothing saying that Yellowstone and The Expanse don't take place in the same universe. There's a lot of creative freedom that you get. Yeah. You just see one cowboy hat in The Expanse. You know, one guy with a cowboy hat. And then it's like, there he is. There's Yellowstone himself.
I mean, like, doesn't Alex speak with like a
Alex Kumel, yeah, and his twang.
From his Texas family.
Yeah.
I guess that's not Montana or Yellowstone, but
there are Texans in Yellowstone. So again, that sort of shared universe, the seeds have been sown. This mysterious land called Texas. We're yet to see it.
The creation of a Texas will doom us all.
You want to, Stephen? I don't know if you actually want to talk about radioplasts because it's science.
No one wants to hear about me talk about how cool radioplasts are, but I do want to say
I don't even know what that is.
So one of the plot points that they bring up and then don't explore at all in the television in season 6 of The Expanse is the discovery of radioplasts, which are, you know, like molecular machines that can be put into yeast that can use radiation like plants use the sun. Like a chloroplast is the kind of like quantum machinery that permits, you know, plants to make life on Earth possible. So but they do the same thing but for radiation, which is like extremely cool idea, and I'm sure if you thought about the science of it, probably very problematic. But I think about it a lot, especially because we're also reading another book about radioactive creatures.
I don't think radioplasts, I'm not a scientist. Let me preface this. Nothing I do is scientific. I don't think radioplasts are that problematic because isn't radiation just like, you know, on the light spectrum, but at a different frequency?
Yes. And there's ionizing and non-ionizing. See? So the problem is if you have,
No, there's no problem. There's no problem. There is no problem. It's all just various frequencies of light, and the radioplasts use a frequency of light that chloroplasts don't use. It's totally fine.
The issue becomes when the radiation becomes ionized.
2-on-1.
So if the chloroplasts, like the thing that makes the chloroplasts cool is you can put them out in space and they'll grow because of they can absorb the radiation. But if it's absorbing ionizing radiation, that jeopardizes all of its other cellular machinery. Right. So how is something that eats non-ionizing radiation supposed to have a coherent genome, for example?
Can you have it out in space, or does it need some sort of
I think it would need
to breathe.
It would need medium and air. Like it would need to exist in medium. It would need access to water.
Yeah.
It doesn't grow in vacuum. But the point is you can expose it to the vast radiation of space, which is everywhere.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's a very cool idea, and I'm super stoked on it, and I think about it all the time.
Radioplasts now.
Radioplasts.
Thinking about them, radioplasts.
But again, a lot of problems, because you would then need a whole other structure for like doing a whole bunch of cellular processes that would be threatened. So
something to think about, something to chew on.
All right, just... Evan, do you have anything more you want to say about season 6 of The Expanse?
I have become one of the world's largest Kamina drummer stans. I mean, she was definitely the highlight of the season for me, performance-wise and sort of writing-wise. So, I don't know. I thought the space battles were very cool. I liked the last episode quite a bit. Lots of shooty explosions. I don't know if we'll ever see The Expanse again, but I had fun with it while it was here.
Steven, final thoughts?
This series is very rich. It's very interesting. I know I don't mean to speak into any broad generalities or impute anything on the authors of the show or the books. But it's got a lot of themes are there, and I think we're just having fun with it and we're engaging with it. And that's why I like it. I also think one of the things we didn't talk about at all was the gender politics of it, which there's like, I think a lot to say there, but our good friends at Hugo Girl recently covered Leviathan Wakes. And they talked about some interesting things about Holden and Naomi's relationship and how that kind of goes. So I encourage people to check that out as well.
Thank you, Evan, so much for being here. We really enjoy Kino Lefter. It is a fantastic show. We've been on a couple of times. You've been here. Where can people find you?
Well, it was a pleasure to be on. I'm a big androids and assets head. So you can find the podcast I do on the podcatcher of your choice. I'm slowly coming back from the holiday break. I've got a few episodes in the can. So yes, it's Kino Lefter, Socialist Film Podcast. The episodes can be covering newly released films or conversations with filmmakers. Two such episodes are coming out soon. I'm covering The Matrix Resurrections with Press Progress's Emily Leadham, who also writes the amazing newsletter Shiftwork that you should subscribe to. And I am also having a conversation with the directors of the rotoscoped adult dark fantasy animated film The Spine of Night, which is one of my favorite movies of 2021. It's a fun conversation. I kept it relatively spoiler light because I just want more people to see the movie. But it was a good conversation. We talked about sort of the world of the film, influences on it, the animation style itself. So I learned a bit about rotoscoped animation. So that was fun. There's also a Patreon, but check it out if you enjoy the podcast. So yeah.
Excellent. Great. And do follow Evan on Twitter. He is a delight.
Yes, I am at McDonald Tweets. I think my current screen name is Dr. Jordan B. Peter from Family Guy.
Again, thank you so much for being here. And thank you, listeners. We love and appreciate all of you. You can find us on the internet, androidsandassets.ca, or on social media, at AssetDroid. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where we will post about our most recent episodes and about very little else. The next time you are looking at the majesty and terror of outer space, maybe just turn us on for everyone around you to listen and feel a little bit better about where we live.